this question, as we'll see, the question of whether a Jew can profit from the sale of arms, from the sale of weapons, basically consists of one line in the Mishnah on the Talmud, so, 1,500 years ago, and then virtually silence for, 1,500 years, because, to be honest, it was very impractical. I mean, Jews weren't really selling arms. They were hoping that maybe they could get some weapons to defend themselves. Usually arms were being used against them in whatever, tragedy happened to be the part of that generation, whether it be the Crusades or the Inquisition or the like. And then, after 1948, as Israel started to develop its military and arms, and started its own arms industry, so the question arose again, whether you could profit from the sales of arms. So as we'll see, our sources will be very... there won't be that much in the medieval material. It'll be a one line here, one line there. The main discussion is in the modern sources, but we'll have to see from the little that there is in the primary sources that the basis for the possible issues with selling weapons and how we would solve them and how we could deal with the fact that Israel does, in fact, make a lot of its money, but more important than the money that it makes from selling arms, it also creates critical political alliances by selling arms, by selling, for example, its Iron Dome technology to countries, being the sort of the newer treaties that are being forged. But even just selling weapons has always been part of, or at least for a while, has been part of Israel's economic and political strategy. So we start with number one, and this is the Mishnah in Avodah Zarah, which is cited in the Gemara on Daf Tet Zayin, where the Gemara says, "Ein mochrin lohem duvim v'arayot v'kol davar sheyesh bo nezek l'rabim." So the Mishnah says that you aren't allowed to sell, meaning to non-Jews, you aren't allowed to sell bears, lions, or anything that may injure the public. You're not allowed to sell wild animals that could be used, or might, even without being used actively, might, of their own accord, damage or hurt the public. Now, based on that, what?
Lahem
is the key word we're going to have to figure out. Lahem, the seemingly here means to non-Jews, right? The assumption being they're going to use them. Now, the question therefore cuts
to selling it
to Jews. Correct. And the question obviously then will arise, it will cut in both directions. What about a Jew who will use it improperly, and what about a non-Jew who will use it properly? Right? Both of those will be questions, but Lahem, right, means...
because they'll use it against us.
Some will say because they will damage people, some will say because they will damage Jews. Right? All these are going to be the questions, but we're not selling bears, lions, usually. But the Braisa, building on the Mishnah, so it's actually the Gemara before the Mishnah, but it incorporates this Mishnah, number two, expands the prohibition, says as follows. But Tanya, the Braisa teaches as follows. It's further been taught. Ein mochrin lahem lo zayin velo klei zayin. You can't sell them weapons or the accessories of weapons. Vein mashchizin lahem en azayin, and you can't sharpen or grind their weapons. Vein mochrin lahem lo stan velo kolarin velo kavalim velo shalshot velo barzel. And you can't sell them stocks or neck chains or ropes or iron chains. Echad ove kochavim vechad kuti. Neither an idolater nor a kuti. Right, meaning these people who thought they were Jews but had some animosity to the Jews, you can't sell it to either of them. My taima, and why can't you sell it to them? So inema dechashid yashvichu damim. If you're going to say the reason you can't sell it to these kutim is because we suspect them of murder, that might not be true. Vichashide, are they really suspect that they're going to engage in murder? So then the Gemara responds, Amar of Dibi Baraba. Kiderech sha'asur limkar lovei kochavim, asur limkar lelistim Yisrael. Right, the prohibition is in fact based on the fact that we suspect that they might use it for illicit purposes, to damage people. And that's why, so if you just follow this line, the Gemara assumed, the Talmud assumed, that the idolaters would use it for negative purposes. assume the average Jew would use it for self-defense, presumably. These kutim, they weren't sure about, and that's why there's this discussion that I erased in the ellipsis. But a Jew that you would suspect, I mean, there are Jews that you would suspect, it was just that normally Jews were being attacked by non-Jews, but there were Jews who were thieves or were known to be highway robbers, so then you couldn't sell weapons either. So the Gemara seems to say pretty clearly the reason we don't sell the weapons is because we don't want to enable people, Jews, non-Jews, whoever it's going to be, to use the weapons negatively. What does negatively mean? We still don't know, but negatively. So the Gemara says, Hechi dami, what are we afraid they're going to do? E dechashed dekatil. If you're worried they're going to use the weapons to murder, so pshita, hainu ove kochavim. So that's the same reason we weren't allowed to sell it to the average idolater, because we assumed they would use it for murder. V'i delo katil, and if the thief is not, we don't assume he's going to kill, amailo. So then why is it prohibited? So the Gemara says, still, lo'olam delo katil, you're right. It's not where he's suspected of murder, v'hachav amai askinan, but what's the case? It refers to someone who's not committed murder, but we may be dealing with a cowardly thief. He said even cowardly thieves who aren't going to try to kill anybody, if they ended up being backed into a corner, so they might kill. And therefore you can't sell weapons to people who are engaged in murder, and even people who you don't suspect are actually going to use their weapons, because anybody who's involved in crime, if you give them a weapon, they may end up using it. And so the Gemara's conclusion, therefore, is basically we can't benefit from arms deals when we can't sell arms, can't sell weapons, when we assume that the arms will be used for illegal purposes. But then the Gemara continues. Tana Rabbana. Ein mochrin lahem trisin. Some people said not only are you not allowed to sell them weapons, but you can't sell them shields. V'yeshomrim mochrin lahem trisin. And some say, while you can't sell them weapons, you can sell them shields. My taima. So why are shields different? So the Gemara says, ilei mishum dim miganu alayhu ihachi afilu chite usire namilo. Right? If you think that the reason, why would you think that you can't sell them shields? So if you think it's because they will, right? Sometimes they'll end up using it, right? So then, I'm going to skip down a little. Just go down to Ika Damri. We'll leave it aside. The first one, Ika Damri. Trace in Hayu Time and Delo. Why would you say you can't sell shields? Because when they finish using their weapons, right, let's say they lose their weapons, or in a modern context, so they would lose, I mean, we don't really use shields, but okay, someone would, right, run out of gunpowder, so now whatever he has, anything that he has in the field, he's going to use as a weapon, right? If you think about the old M16s, if anyone's ever seen the old M16s, right, not the new ones, but the old M16s, the one from the Vietnam War, the ones that if you go around Israel, you'll see in, like, yeshivot, they'll be given, you know, for shmirah, to guard the yeshiva, like the old M16s, right? You've seen these? They're huge at the back, right? Okay, so I'll describe it for a second. If you look at the old M16s, so it's a relatively long gun, right? And in the back is a very heavy, very large, sort of seemingly worthless piece of material at the end. Yeah. Why? The reason was because in Vietnam, right, they needed the ability, when they ran out of ammo, or simply they were in a place where they couldn't shoot, they needed a physical weapon to hit somebody with. So the back is a club, right? Which makes it very hard to use, right? Make it very hard to use the old M16s. But the Gemara is saying basically the same thing, right? In modern warfare, so people would use an M16, and when they ran out of ammunition, so they would hit somebody with the back of the gun. In their times, the reason the person thinks you can't sell shields, because if they drop their sword, right, then they would take their shield and they'd, right, club the person over the head. It's also a weapon. V'yesh omrim, And the other position says, no, that's not true. When you drop your sword, you don't plunge into battle with your shield. You run the other way, right? You don't, you know, if you don't have a weapon, you don't go into to fight. But again, you see the Gemara's assumption is that anything that would be a weapon, realistically be a weapon, is a problem. The question is whether a shield falls in that category, but the Gemara is going in that same direction, that weapons are problematic to sell. Yeah?
Someone back and pick up a big rock and throw it off, or it's different.
Right, and that's really the point, is that if he's going to use it, fine, but it's unlikely it's going to be that more than anything else.
It has to be an actual weapon.
Right.
If it isn't anything on the ground, take a stick, it doesn't make any difference.
Right, that might be part of it, right, that anything, right, if it's just being used, you know, not as weapons, you don't have anything else, so you'll find something else, right? I took for a while martial arts, and they said one of the first things you learn is learn how to see your surroundings and figure out what could be used as a weapon if you needed it, right? That's one of the things you learn, that anything could be a weapon, right? If you know, an umbrella, a rock, right, a stick, whatever, anything can be used as a weapon if you know how to use it right. So Amar Rav Nachman, Amar Rabba Ravua, Halacha Kei Shomrim, we rule that it's not a problem, you are allowed to sell shields. Amar Rav Ada Bar Ahava, a mochon l'mashoshio shel barzel. Not only can't you sell them weapons, but you can't sell them bars of iron. So let's look at the English. Why? Because they may hammer weapons out of them, right? Not only can't you sell weapons, you can't sell the metal, the raw material to make weapons. And if so, spades and pickaxes too should be forbidden. You shouldn't be able to sell them, you know, gardening tools, because you could use them as weapons. And as we, right, if you look in Sefer Shoftim, in the Book of Judges, right, when they didn't have weapons, that was what they used, right? When it was forbidden for Jews to own weapons under enemy rule, so when they wanted to mount a rebellion, so they took, you know, shovels and, you know, spades and any other somewhat sharp metal object that they had. So it should be forbidden to sell gardening tools. So said Reb Zvid, we mean bars of Indian iron. It was apparently a special type of metal. That was what they used for weapons. Okay. But then the Gemara asked the key question. Okay, it's very nice. There's this prohibition to sell arms. Except, apparently in the time of the Talmud, people did sell arms. So the Talmud says, why then do we sell it now? Why, if it's forbidden to sell arms, do we sell arms? So the Talmud says, said Reb Ashi, we sell it to the Persians who protect. Because the Persians, they were under Persian rule, they actually protect us from other enemies. So we sell it to, maybe not our best friends, but the people who maintain order and protect us from other enemies, so we sell them weapons. So from the main Talmudic passage, this is what we get. One is that there's a general prohibition to sell weapons. Two, people who the assumption is will use it for illicit purposes, right? For negative purposes, for crimes. Two, we're allowed to sell defensive weapons, I guess, because we assume that that's not going to be used for offense, right? That was a dispute, but that was the way the Gemara rules. And the third point is that we can even sell offensive weapons if we assume the purpose of the offensive weapons will not be crimes, but will be defense, will be protection, will be something good. Right? Those are basically the three principles that you pull out of the main Talmudic passage. So as we'll see when we get to the modern opinions, each of these can manifest itself in modern Israel. We'll see more in a minute, but even just from here, right? If I asked you, take these three principles, right? And just based on these three principles, why could we argue that even if you aren't supposed to sell arms, the state of Israel should be allowed to sell arms? What? Right, one would be allies,
defensive,
right? Which is
defensive
weapons. What? Right. So one would be defensive weapons. So like selling the Iron Dome would be presumably the equivalent of selling shields, right? It's not a weapon. It's a defense mechanism. Now, allies, right? If we wanted to expand from the permission given to sell weapons to those who are going to protect us. Right? Selling weapons to people in order to forge strategic alliances is just half a jump, right? It's just a minor jump from saying we sell it to people who are actively defending us. We might be allowed to sell to people who, by virtue of forging the relationship, we are protected. And the third is, based on the first point, is as we saw, while the Talmud says it's prohibited to sell to non-Jews, it's clear by the fact that it also prohibits it to Jews who might use it for illicit purposes, then really what the Talmud means is you can't sell it to people you will assume will do something wrong with them, which, under some circumstances, we might be comfortable that our allies are not doing that. But that last one is the trickiest of the three, because that's never clear, right? For example, right, Iran, right? Meaning when we sold to Iran in the previous regime, whatever we sold there has remained, right, into the current regime, right? It's not always, that one is not going to help you very much, because you never quite know where weapons are going to end up once you sell it into potentially hostile neighbors.
The theory is that if you arm someone sufficiently with offensive weapons, then they will not have to use them, because they're basically going to be strong enough that no one will attack them. You hope they're not going to attack anyone else. And so even an offensive weapon is a kind of sense of defensive weapon, in this, because people who get attacked tend to be weaker. People who are very strong don't get attacked by anyone because they're very strong. But they don't seem to fix on that kind of concept at that time, that an offensive weapon is really a defensive weapon.
Right. I mean, I think in the ancient world it wasn't as much. Yeah. Right? I mean, like, if you read, I don't know if you ever read through Thucydides, it's like 1,500 pages and a bit tedious, but if you read through the history of the Peloponnesian Wars, you see that it's not quite like that. Meaning, Sparta loved showing off that they were strong and they attacked just because they could, and they liked attacking Athens just to show that they were stronger than Athens, even though Athens was stronger than Sparta in the sense that they lived in a walled city, that the only way in and out was by ship, right? Like, really, and they had the strongest navy. So if Sparta came, Sparta would try to tempt them by, you know, burning down their fields outside the walls, and Athens would just get on a ship and sort of leave, right? So there was a power struggle. Like, in the ancient world, you fought to show your power and get tribute, right, or just express dominance, which still exists to an extent in certain parts of the world. In the Middle East, this is still true, right? I remember at some point I had a week-long seminar with Michael Doran, who was one of the Middle East advisors to the Bush administration, where he was explaining, right, a lot of, from the documents that we now know of what went into the discussions of why people fought certain wars, it's, you know, you use it, you know, you don't just have weapons to show strength, you fight to show strength in certain cultures. So it's not always true.
I think Richard's point is you don't attack somebody unless you believe you're going to be able to beat them.
But that's not always true, right? That's what's, in the Middle East, not always true. Sometimes you'll attack, right, to show your strength, even if you expect you're going to lose, because there's other calculations, like, you know, in 48 you find this, right, that some of the Arab countries thought that they would lose if they entered the war, but they knew that if they entered the war, all the other Arab nations would have to enter the war, right, to defend them. So they didn't think they were strong enough, but they thought they could trigger a war, and since they were the first ones, they would have a show of strength. Right, so it's not always true. It's sometimes true. It depends on the political culture.
They were kind of surprised that they did as well.
Yeah, there's a lot going on. Politics and culture is different in different places. But the point is, offensive weapons can, at the end of the day, be used defensively, and often are. Not always, but you're right. One of the questions they ask is, what if someone's buying offensive weapons for defensive purposes? Is that different? Maybe, yeah.
The problem is that the Israelis sell to both sides. I know this is a fact.
So
both defensive. Because they sell to both sides. In the same war, both sides get weapons from Israelis.
Right, well, so that's one of the interesting questions, right? If you sell to two sides of a battle, not your own battle, but in order to protect yourself by having defensive alliances with yourself, right, which is what Israel sometimes does, right, that still might work, right? Because you're not selling it because you think their war is just.
No,
you're selling the weapons.
Africa. I'm just talking Africa. Nothing to do with Israelis at all. They're selling both sides. Both sides can kill each other. It's nothing to do with Israelis at all. It's not defensive.
They're selling it a lot to actually build political alliances.
Right, that's true.
And that's what I'm saying, is if you're selling to two sides of a different conflict for your own, right, safety, right, to forge alliances.
Right, these are selling conflicts that have nothing to do with Israelis, and they sell to both sides.
Correct, but it's the alliance that's important. That's what I'm saying.
Right, covering both sides. If we're going to win, we get them.
Yeah, so. I mean, that's the way you really, that's the way, in a bit of a cynical world, but we live in a cynical world, you forge alliances. Okay. So let's look at the reasons that the commentaries give for this prohibition and then try to open up some of the more directions. We already started pointing in the directions of why it might be permitted under certain circumstances, but let's continue. So in number three, the Ritva, Rabbi Yom Tov Asvili, writes that the reason that you are allowed to sell the weapons So he says, the reason you can sell weapons to the Persians, he says, is since they save us with weapons, it is permitted, and we do not worry about placing a stumbling block before the blind. So he says two things which are important here. He says, one, the reason that we don't sell weapons is because of what's called lifnei iver, placing a stumbling block before the blind. We don't want to be responsible for the crimes that the other person commits. But then he says something important, right? We might have thought that the reason you're allowed to sell to the Persians who are protecting us, right, is because you assume they're only protecting us and not using it for crimes. Right? The Ritva tells it, it says that's not the case. Even though we are concerned they're going to use it for other bad purposes, since they also protect us, we don't have to worry about the possibility they're going to use it for crimes. I mean, they may or may not use it for crimes. We don't have to be assured of that as long as it's, as long as it, right, because that's waived because we want to be protected, right? Which, coming back to Moshe's case, would tell us that there's at least room to say that even though the concern is we don't sell weapons because we don't want to be aiding and abetting people who are involved in illegal wars, if it's necessary for us to sell weapons to them in order to create strategic alliances, it may be fine anyways, because the Ritva is telling you two things. One is that normally we're worried about enabling crime, but we don't have to think too far in advance as long as we're doing it not because we want to help the crime, but because we need the right political capital, we need the alliance, or in this case, just protection. Okay.
That's a very subjective.
Yes, I'm just
process.
What?
That's a very subjective process.
Well, when you take it from the person, well, when you take it from the context of the Talmud and jump into the international sphere, it will be, and then we have to figure out whether it's true. In their circumstance, it wasn't, right? The Persians had taken their had taken on the responsibility of protecting them, so they sold them weapons, and then whatever they did beyond that wasn't their responsibility. Right, you're right. In the international sphere, right, it's much more subjective because, right, it's not like the nation has, you know, the nations we sell arms to have promised, oh, now we're going to protect the state of Israel. It's, we're hedging that this will cement a political alliance and they'll only do whatever they do wherever they do it and not against us.
The big difference is between a guarantee and having leverage.
Correct, correct. And that's why the jump is still a jump, but this opens it, yeah.
In this excerpt from the Gemara, It seems to imply that if the listim weren't murderers or potential murderers, you would be able to sell.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like crimes. We mean specifically violent crimes, right? Not just.
But why is that? Why would you be allowed to sell to an Ofer Avera?
So it sounds like we're only worried about selling weapons if we're concerned that the weapons will be used for the crime, right? Meaning the fact that someone happens to be a bad person was not of concern, right? Meaning, I could sell
it's
a known criminal
to the crime.
Right, that's what it sounds like, right? Because they're saying if you sold a weapon to someone who isn't going to use it in his crime, so, right? Meaning, for example, if someone you know to be, I don't know, guilty of, pick your crime, insider trading. Okay, fine. Right, I gave a lecture on it yesterday. It's on my mind. You know, somebody is a white collar criminal. You know it. Whatever. Maybe he'll be caught. Maybe he won't be caught. Whatever the case may be. But the fact is, he lives in a somewhat dangerous neighborhood. I don't know. Right. He lives in Johannesburg. Right. Everyone has weapons. So he's a criminal. But you're selling him a weapon, and you don't think he's going to go. He's not going to do insider trading. He doesn't need a gun to do insider trading. Right, but the Talmud is saying basically the same thing, right? If you have somebody who might use his weapons in his crime, so then you're enabling the crime. If you know that the guy steals, you know, is starving to death, and he doesn't hold anybody up, right? He lives in the inner city. It's really dangerous, and whatever. He happens to steal food because he's starving to death. It's not a good idea. It's not good. He's not allowed to steal, but you don't expect he'll ever use the weapon. You know that there's a fruit stand outside, and he always goes by and takes an apple because he's starving to death, right? He's a thief, but it's no different than selling, in that case, to the insider trader, because the weapon isn't enabling the crime, right? So the Talmud assumes, because we only can't sell weapons if the weapons are part of the crime. If he happens to be a criminal, that would be different. Now, again, what would happen in a case where someone isn't known to be a violent criminal, but you know, right, he's is a drug dealer. He's never been convicted of a violent crime, but you know that the way of the world is that the more people descend into drug trafficking, the more likely they'll be involved in, right, violent crime or be caught up in a violent situation. In that case, it's probably like the Gemara's case, that the thief you think that might end up in that situation, you can't sell it to, right? But it's always going to be someone where you have to look down the line and you see violence as a function of their crime.
But the guy who steals the apple,
yeah,
can turn that
just
on
the water. What?
No, the water. Yeah.
What?
The guy who steals the apple can turn to armed robbery once you give him the weapon.
Theoretically, right, and then you have to figure out, is that actually going to happen? I don't know if it's a good idea to sell to a thief, but, you know, but again, on the one hand, yes. On the other hand, what happens if he really lives in the, you know, in a very dangerous part of the city, and he really needs a weapon to protect himself, right? The question gets a little bit more murky. Okay, if you look in 4, in Reyos of Chaviva, then Mukai Yosef, so he says, what was the problem to begin with? This isn't about Lifnei Iver. It's not a spiritual accounting. It's not that we don't want to be responsible for his crimes, so we don't sell weapons to someone who might use it for murder. That may be true, that may not be true. The reason you don't sell weapons is self-preservation. We don't sell weapons to those who kill us. Now, according to that explanation, why is it that you're allowed to sell it to the Persians? Because they protect us, right? This is totally a self-preservation Gemara. It's a law that says you can't sell to those who might use it against you, and if your best guess is that someone's going to continue protecting you, then you can sell them. The Rambam, Maimonides in number 5, says it's not about Jews. No, it's not about Lifnei Iver. It's not just that we're worried about sin. It's not just that we're worried about self-preservation. We care about the moral and societal stability of the world. And why can't you sell it? To not aid those who destroy the land in their destruction. It's not just that we don't want to be, you know, responsible for their spiritual downfall, that they committed a sin. No. We care about the stability of the world. And if you sell weapons to the wrong people, you, not them, you are responsible for destabilizing the political situation. And that's a problem. You aren't allowed to do that.
So the Rambam here is saying that you shouldn't, that you're not allowed, it's an Isser, it's Usser, right? You're not allowed, whether it's from the Torah or it's rabbinic, you're not allowed to sell weapons. A guy is a Jewish guy, he's selling weapons. He's in the weapon business, and he would like to sell weapons and profit from it. He cannot sell. The luck is he's not allowed to sell the weapons in these circumstances. And the reason is because there's this general concept that he can't be participating. There's no specific love. There's no specific thing he's doing wrong. It's just this general idea that it's a general moral concept. It's just not a mitzvah, but it's a general moral concept.
I mean, it's more than
something that's not that detracts from stability in the world?
I think it's more. I don't think it's less than. I think it's more than, right? It's that murder, specifically, is more than just a crime, right? It's a crime, right? And therefore, because Lifnei Iver, as we'll see, Lifnei Iver in general, as we'll see in a moment, is a very technical prohibition. It's only if they couldn't do it without you, right? So if, like the Ritva is right, I can't sell weapons because it's Lifnei Iver, so then it would only be prohibited if they couldn't buy weapons for somebody else.
So he's expanding it.
So correct.
Isn't that a problematic? In other words, that when you said it's because of Lifnei Iver, you say it's because you're somehow assisting in murder or something. Then I understand there's a law in the Torah, you don't have to do something. And by selling arms, you're somehow breaking that law. But it's interesting to me that he says, well, no, it's not that. It's not a specific law. What it is this general concept. With human beings, we understand there's a general concept, but it's not a specific prohibition anywhere. They just say, look, you're a moral person, you're a Jew, you're not allowed to sell weapons that do destabilize situations, and then that's not a specific mitzvah.
Correct. Right, and that, and the Rambam therefore expands it. Yeah.
But would he say that's rabbinic?
This whole thing is rabbinic. Presumably rabbinic, yeah.
But if you take the Rambam literally, then there is no way that you can sell them at all, even if they're defending you, and even if they're...
So that's what the Gemara, that's what the Rambam would have to say, is that even though we don't want to be engaged in this, there's a limit to which we can deal, right? The limit to which we can be so pure, right? Meaning the world is a tough place.
What does he say?
No, I mean, the Gemara already says you're allowed to sell defensive weapons and you're allowed to sell if they're protecting us. I mean, what the Rambam would have to say, on the one hand, we don't want to, you know, bring more violence into the world. On the other hand, if there is violence and we need to sell weapons to protect ourselves, then that's fine. Right? I mean, it's a balance. On the one hand, we wish the world were less violent. On the other hand, it is violence. You need a balance. And that's really what the Rambam is going to end up saying. The Nebuchadnezzar Yosef in 6, right, puts the calculus as follows, right? He says, why is it we're allowed to sell to the Persians? They protect us. They fight for us to protect the city and its inhabitants. And that's a certainty. Killing a Jew is doubtful. And this is what we rely on, right? He said, it's just a trade-off. We know that when we sell weapons to somebody, they might end up using it for crimes elsewhere. We don't want to destabilize the world. We don't want to bring violence to the world. That's fine. But we don't really know what they're going to do. We know that right now we need them. That's a certainty. That's doubtful. So yeah, it may not be ideal, but even the Rambam's going to admit that you got to do this. Now, his last line, that is what we rely on, is important. Said, in fact, right, in the Middle Ages, apparently sometimes they did sell weapons because, for whatever reason, right, in just some circumstances, they had the ability to make weapons and sell it to people who were protecting them. Okay. Now, what is going to be the difference, though, between different positions? So, as I said, if this is about Lifnei Iver, it's about us being responsible for the spiritual standing of other people. So then, it's going to be a very limited law. Because, in number 7, the standard law by Lifnei Iver is as follows. There are nothing said. How do we know that you can't hand a cup of wine to a Nazir, or a piece of flesh from a live animal to a non-Jew, right? A Nazirite can't drink wine, so you can't give him a cup of wine. And you can't give live animal to a non-Jew who can't eat it, neither can Jews, but meaning even non-Jews. And the answer is, it says, you're not placed a stumbling block before the blind. But then the Talmud asks, but wouldn't the sinner take it even if the other did not give it to him? So the Gemara responds, here what are we dealing with? When they're standing on two sides of the river, Trei Avrei Denahara. And the normal halacha is as follows. If you think the prohibition is Lifnei Iver, so it's only considered that you are responsible for someone else committing a sin if you not just helped them, but you enabled it. If without you, it couldn't have happened. Right? Now, this obviously would create a huge room for leniency in the practical law, because right, until now we've said it's problematic to sell to countries who might use it for negative purposes unless they protect us. But if it's about Lifnei Iver, then that's only going to be true if they could only buy weapons from Israel. If they're going to buy weapons from Russia, so then might as well be Israel, so at least we'll have, right, we're not enabling them, right, we're just profiting off their inevitable, right, buying of weapons. However, there is a qualification, which is in the Ramah, in 8, if you just look at the English here, it says, however, there may be a rabbinic prohibition called Misayeya, which means that even when they don't need you to commit the sin, but you're helping them, it might be prohibited rabbinically. So some say that it's only prohibited to sell them things related to their service when they don't have others like them or can't buy them somewhere else. But if they can buy them somewhere else, it is permitted to sell them anything. And some are stringent, and the custom is like the first position, and one who is careful should be strict on himself. So there's at least room to think about the possibility that it would be problematic even if they could get weapons elsewhere, but that's already a dispute, and if As the Ramah says, if there's a real reason for it, so you could be lenient, because it's only a stringency. Really, we paskin, especially when we're dealing with non-Jews. And non-Jews, if it's Lifnei Iver, it's about putting a stumbling block, we only prohibit it when they couldn't have done it without us. Now, so far, just to sort of summarize what we've seen so far, based on these different explanations, we have possible reasons to justify selling arms in the state of Israel, even though there is the prohibition. Because either, if it's about Lifnei Iver, if it's about putting a stumbling block, they could buy it elsewhere. If it's about destroying the world, well, if it's someone who's using it for, you know, good purposes, or it's for forging a strategic alliance with us, then we've seen that under those circumstances permitted, either despite the fact that they're going to do things which aren't questionable as well, or because we assume that the type of people we're forging an alliance with won't do negative things with it. And defensive things like the Iron Dome are going to be permitted because those aren't weapons to begin with. In 9, Rabbi Yaakov Epstein, I just gave you a summary, says something fascinating. He says, until now we've assumed that we could make the jump from the prohibition to sell to individual non-Jews to the prohibition to sell to nations, and then we have to find a reason why nations might be permitted. But he says, maybe this is all off. And he says as follows. If the reason that it's prohibited to sell arms is because of Lifnei Iver, because you're responsible for the sin someone else isn't going to commit, so you can sell a weapon to an individual who might kill because murder is unacceptable. But war in halacha is not unacceptable. There are circumstances under which war is permitted, which means that when you sell to a nation is not going to usually be involved in murder. They might be involved in war. But since war is not the same as murder, and war has, ironically, more circumstances in which it is legitimate than killing individuals, it might be that the state is allowed to sell arms because nations being involved in a war is ironically not as bad as individuals being engaged in murder, because war is not always murder. The flip side, which I would say to Rabbi Yaakov Epstein, is that's a nice reason to suggest that, but if there's a reason to suspect that they're going to be engaged in an unjust war, right? There is no justification for an unjust war, right? An unjust war would just be mass murder. So I think it cuts both ways there. On the one hand, yes, just wars may be permitted, right? May not be murder, but unjust words are just mass murder. So
didn't he also live at a time where there was no Jewish state?
Yaakov Epstein?
Yeah.
No, Yaakov Epstein is not. This particular Yaakov Epstein is a guy who's alive currently, who lived in Gush Katif and was kicked out of Gush Katif. He writes in Israel. He lives in, like, I don't know where he lives anymore. He used to live in Gush Katif, and in one of his volumes he says, I write this in memory of my community, which doesn't exist anymore, and I have now moved to somewhere else. There are other Epsteins, but this particular one, Chelel Nachlato, is a guy who lives in Israel now and is writing now. Similarly, the Seder Yaakov, and Rabbi Yaakov Rahavtik quotes this, says that there's another reason you could sell it to governments, is because, even not war, governments are allowed to have weapons, right? Let's say you sold it to a country to, not for their army, but for their police force, right? Well, countries are allowed to have police force. They're allowed to use force to enforce justice. That's permitted. So he says maybe, again, so far we've been trying to jump from the permission to sell to individuals under certain circumstances, nations. Both Rabbi Epstein and the Seder Yaakov suggest perspectives in which maybe we're just approaching this the wrong way. Maybe we don't even need the permission because nations are just fundamentally different and are allowed to use force. And therefore, selling weapons to nations is actually less problematic than selling to individuals. Okay, if you continue to 10, the Rambam formulates it as follows. He says, when the Jews dwell among the idolaters and have established a covenant with them, it is permissible to sell weapons to the servants of the king and to his soldiers, because they use them to wage war against the enemies of the country and to protect it. Thus, they also protect us, for we dwell among them. The Rambam specifically, right, we already suggested before that maybe the reason that you're, that justification from the Gemara, that you're allowed to sell to the Persians who protect us, could be expanded to allow you to sell for the purpose of creating treaties, right, strategic alliances. The Rambam seems to have already made that jump, right, because he says, you can sell it to the Persians not just because they protect us, but his line there, kartu lahem brit, because we've forged an alliance with them such that they protect us among the other people. So some of the modern commentaries point out that the Rambam seems to have actually had this in mind, that the notion that you can sell weapons to protect yourself is not limited to physically they will protect us. It's to forging alliances which in turn protect us. Right, and they quote also the Meiri in 15, who says, "V'kol adam chotzeh b'tzilo ra'u la'azrok v'yashar." It's proper for anyone who shelters him right, to help anyone who helps shelters him as much as possible. Basically, anyone who we owe our security to in any way, shape, or form, because we have an alliance with them, according to the Rambam, according to the Meiri, it should be permitted. So far what we've had is the possibility that it's permitted because either nation states are different, they could buy the weapons elsewhere, they use it in some circumstances for defense, it allows us to create strategic alliances that protect us, and that allows us to waive the other problems. A fifth reason to be lenient is what's found in the Meiri in 12, and this is a position the Meiri says in many places, which is that all of these prohibitions, when the Talmud says don't sell it to idolaters, that meant pagans, because pagans were assumed to have no moral culture at all. But anyone who's from a nation, number 12, anyone who's from a nation which is civilized by religion and believe in God, there's no doubt that even if you do not know them, it is permitted and proper to sell, that you're allowed to sell to what he calls civilized nations. As many of the modern commentaries have pointed out, the fact that, let's say, a nation, the fact that many of the nations in the Middle East are Muslim and therefore religious, right, doesn't help us on this count, right? So invoking the Meiri shouldn't, what?
Like ISIS.
No, this is obvious. Right? This, to me, this is obvious, right? What? And the Crusades. To me, this is obvious. I should note, the Meiri is talking generally, right? Not just about this prohibition, about basically all of them in the Perek. As many of the modern commentaries point out, historically, the fact that someone is religious and not a pagan should not help on this count at all. So I'm just going to leave that one. I raised it. I've left it on the side. Let's move on. Okay. Fine. Another possibility, the Rush.
Rabbi, but the Meiri, you know, he lived in the world too. I mean,
he's actually not commenting just on weapons. He's making a general discussion of the whole the chapter, which is all types of things you can't sell to non-Jews.
Yeah.
Trying to apply to weapons is questionable.
Yeah.
Okay. Another one in 13, I'll just say it outside. The Rush also says that one of the things we use nowadays to allow things, right, the first chapter of Avodah Zarah has a list of things you aren't allowed to sell to non-Jews, types of business deals you can't have with non-Jews. But in general, if it will cause animosity, we waive the rabbinic prohibition. So any time when it would create actual friction, right, if you didn't, you know, help somebody out and sell them weapons or sell them defense weapons or something like that, that's yet another reason to be lenient. Okay, so as I noted, in 14 I just gave you, that Rabbi Yaakov Epstein is among many who suggest that political alliances are permitted under the rubric of defense. So again, just to summarize what we've seen, and then I'll finish up. While there is this prohibition to sell weapons to individual non-Jews, because they might use it for illicit purposes, and again, also to Jews who might use it for illicit purposes, that just wasn't the reality most of the time. The reasons to permit it under our circumstances, the reason Israel's engaged in it, even though they didn't necessarily ask Shilas, though some of them did, was A, nations might be different. B, we need it for defense, because in the way of political alliances. C, some of our allies, at least we hope, are using it for good, so we're not actually worried that they're involved in crime. Four, is that they could buy it elsewhere, so if it's about Lifnei Iver, then that problem doesn't apply. And as well, in some circumstances, it'll generate animosity. If we don't sell them, that would be a reason to permit, especially to our political allies, is to forge strategic alliances.
It seems here that you have to, considering the political turmoil in any generation, it seems that the rulers, or rather the paskim at the time, would have to evaluate, is this the right thing to do at this time? Because what happens if the nation who you think is your friend is turning against you? Look at
Right, so that was the example I used of Iran, right? Iran, in the 70s, exactly. We sold to them, and now they're enemies. So the poskim do bring this up. The poskim bring up that all of this only opens the door to saying that if it's going to be politically wise, and the nation is a nation that you don't think is going to use it against you, you're allowed to sell it. That doesn't say you should. That's a question that should be left to political strategists. This just sets the theoretical rubric that says you're allowed to if.
Right.
But rabbis should not get involved, right? I'm a student of religion scene who said very clearly, the job of rabbis is to set the theoretical framework and then back out, because filling in those details, there's no reason, in Smicha we did not learn, right, political strategy, right? Halacha, maybe I'm competent to talk about, maybe I'm not, but I know I'm not competent to talk about whether it's a good idea or not to sell weapons. That I leave to the general. This is just opening up the theoretical. I'm just going to summarize and then I'll stay for questions at the end. One last, a few last issues that people brought up. One is, while this has all raised reasons why it's potentially okay, one of the reasons that it might still not be okay, even if you could solve the technical problems, is this what several modern thinkers point out, but I gave from Rabbi Yaakov Vorhofstig, is that in Jews in general, we don't like violence, and we have a reputation for not liking violence, of being peaceful, and for good reason. We really do philosophically want peace. For example, he points to the Mishnah in 15, right? The Mishnah says as follows, right? A man must not go out with a sword, a bow, shield, lance, or a spear, and if he does go out, he incurs a sin offering, meaning on the Shabbat, on the Sabbath. Rulazar said, they're ornaments for him, right? Why not, right? You look, your sword is it's a decoration, right? You look like a knight, right? It adds to the ambiance, right? It adds to your image. It's a piece of clothing. You could wear it on Shabbos. But the sages maintain, no, you can't wear weapons on Shabbat, again, barring situations of actual, you know, danger, because they're merely shameful. For it is said, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. And based on that Jewish belief that even if weapons are necessary, we wish they weren't, Rabbi Vorhofstig in number 16 says as follows, we can't forget to consider the concern for desecration in the name of God that could be caused when the Jews, who have been privileged after thousands of years of being chased and killed, to establish their own state with the grace of God, and they increase murder and killing the world through weapons that are sold to nations, and not necessarily the most perfected ones, which is a nice way of saying that, right? So one of the things, again, this doesn't open or close the discussion, but for all the reasons one can bring why it might be permitted, you also have to think about the counter, which is even if you can technically permit it, if you're selling it to nations who are going to use it for problematic things, you will be complicit in that. And even if it's technically permitted, right? The fact that just there's something wrong about that is at least something that should be taken into account. I forgot to mention, there is one of the rabbinic articles, which is written by a rabbi slash like a general, I think, or political thinker, I'm not exactly sure, a politician, where he does raise the point that the reason he opposes selling arms is simply because he thinks it's not true, that it creates good political alliances. He thinks it's just in general, on balance, bad. But again, that's a practical concern. And 17, I gave you, Rav Yaakov Talidana was asked about this, and he did forbid selling weapons in, I think, like 1950s Israel, or maybe earlier, but that was to the Arabs surrounding them, because they were being used against them, right? I mean, just because you can find leniencies doesn't mean there are circumstances where the original reasons do apply, which is worth keeping in mind. Rav Eliyahu Abrizal, on the other hand, now moving again from the nations just to individual, right? Just one line about the individuals. In Israel, right, if you have a gun shop and a non-Jew comes in, right, so none of the political alliance things are going to apply, can you sell them guns? So this comes back to Steve's point before. Rav Abrizal says yes. Because, you know, the average, let's say, in Israel it's actually very hard to buy weapons it's hard to buy weapons, period, right? People don't realize that because you see weapons all the time. It's actually very hard to, they're very strict gun controls. In certain places, it's much easier, like in Gush Etzion and the like, where it's assumed to be more dangerous, right? And people there can bypass much of the process. But let's say a Christian living in Gush Etzion approaches a gun store and asks for a gun, right? He says in those circumstances, you can sell it to him, because even though it's an offensive weapon, the same reason it's easy for people living in Gush Etzion to buy a gun, because there's an assumption that things are a bit more dangerous, and the gun, even though it's normally offensive, is really a defensive weapon. The same thing is true of people that are assumed to, right? Now, the equivalent of making sure they didn't use it for crimes is probably a background check or something like that. But assuming you can actually be relatively certain that, you know, the Christian living in the Gush Etzion is buying a gun for the same reason the Jews are buying guns in Gush Etzion for self-defense, he says, in those circumstances, it would be mutter, it would be permitted based on simply the issues we saw above. So again, on the one hand, we saw that there are many ways to justify both, in certain circumstances, private sales, but the more pressing question in modern Israel, national sale of arms to other nations. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, we do have to remember the counter, the balance of that, which is if those arms are also going to be used for negative things that may be prohibited or at the very least cause a desecration of God's name, which we then have to weigh with the positive benefits that come from it. So that's really the summary of the modern issue as it stands. I won't read number 18, but on 18 I just gave you a summary from Rabbi Shlomo Brody, which is really a lecture for another time, which is leaving aside the question of selling arms. If you are selling arms, how, not on a national level, but on an individual level, does halach have a perspective on gun control, right? What gun control should look like? So you can follow up the article. I can send out the link to it, or you could just Google any line that's here. But this is his summary of what he thinks gun control would look like in perspective of halach, but that's really going to be a lecture for another time. I don't know when.